in places that were exposed to the drought and had access to credit, you see a leapfrogging. Those places now invest in mechanized forms of farming that even make them more productive than the places that never had the drought in the first place.
Welcome to Vox Dev Talks. My name is Tim Phillips. In 2023, we've seen a lot of extreme weather events, and we've seen many more in recent years as well. And in future, we're going to have to cope with a more volatile climate. But how can we increase the resilience of the most vulnerable communities? An analysis of droughts in the US in the 1950s shows the impact of the financial sector in helping communities to adapt to large climate shocks, and also what happens when credit is not available. Raghuram Rajan of the Chicago Booth School and Rodney Ramcharan of USC did the research. They join me now. Raghuram, welcome to Vox Dev Talks.
Thanks for having me.
And Rodney, welcome as well.
Thank you, Tim.
So we're not talking about avoiding a change in the climate in this case. We're talking about adapting to it. So linking that to what we're seeing now, is it inevitable that we're going to need more and better adaptation strategies in the future?
Almost surely, right? Because on the current path, we are probably going to blow through the 1.5 degrees centigrade warming since pre-industrial times that scientists warn us could be a line in the sand, after which bad things happen. We're already seeing a fair number of problematic events, the forest fires, for example, the flooding. And so, especially in the most vulnerable parts of the world, South Asia, Sub-Saharan Africa, parts of South America, we are likely to see the brunt of the effects, which then means that many of these countries have to start focusing on adaptation, hoping that over time things go back, that yes, we blow through the 1.5 degrees centigrade, but then we find ways to bring down the level of carbon in the atmosphere over time, and hopefully some of the effects will reverse. But clearly, the first order of action for some of these countries is how do we ensure that we survive for the rest of the century? That certainly means more efforts at adaptation.
And this research is all about coping with drought. Now, we know what a drought is, but how does drought affect a community economically in the short run? How does it affect it in the long run?
We're focused on farming and agriculture, and droughts play a powerful role there because, of course, a key feature of farming is access to water. And with the drought of the 1950s, unexpectedly, precipitation stopped in 1947, and it didn't really come back again until 1957, 1958. And so the loss of access to water means that a lot of the livestock died, a lot of the plantings failed, the crops failed, and that led to a great deal of hardship because the farmers were in debt because you borrow to sort of finance these transactions. And then when the drought comes and you don't get the chance to sort of reap the harvest, you can't sell, there isn't anything to sell. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of farmers gradually got into cash flow squeezes throughout the 1950s. Do you continue farming or do you give it up and go do something else? And that's the setting, that's the context in which we try to study what access to finance does.
And this is set in the context of the United States. This was the second biggest drought in the 20th century, the most devastating being the drought during the Great Depression, the Dust Bowl. There's a worse drought which ended recently, but it was less impactful in the sense that the share of people dependent on agriculture in the United States is much lower than it was in the 50s when we look at it. Two things to note. First, the per capita income in the United States in the 50s is about the level of an upper middle income country today. Mm-hmm. So it has all the trappings of an upper middle income country, certainly has a reasonable safety net. And yet we see that people have to migrate in large quantities when the drought hits. So that's an example of the effects in a fairly well-to-do country today. But of course, the effects in a poorer country without the government supports, without the safety nets, are going to be worse. And that's where the private arrangements that we talk about, the access to finance, may actually play an even bigger part than the one we note in the paper. Obviously, we already have a government structure in place in the 50s in the United States.
How is finance helping communities to cope? What is the mechanism in this case?
So let me give the easy version, and then Rodney will give the more detailed and thoughtful version. I mean, think about the farmer, right? And you're hit by drought-like conditions. The first year, you say, okay, I'll endure this. The second and third year, you say, what can I do to actually manage? And part of the way to manage is investment. I dig wells to find the water, which is in underground reservoirs. And maybe I have to dig deep because the level has shrunk further. But that's one way of coping, to bring in irrigation facilities. And they did a lot of that. Another way of coping as a producer is you start different crops. Mm-hmm. And finance helps you take that risk, because one of the reasons you stay with the current crop is you don't know what happens. You don't know how to cultivate the new crop, but maybe a new problems that emerge. The access to finance gives you a certain amount of insurance, which allows you to take that kind of risk. But it also gives you the money to invest in those new crops, to buy the new seeds and whatever new fertilizers, etc. you need. Basically, from the producer side, adaptation becomes easier when you have access to finance. From the consumer side, of course, it also allows you to endure. In the initial years of the drought, maybe you borrow a little more to put food on the table. And then people find ways to cope. Your farmer has found ways to grow crops under this different environment. The access to finance allows you a temporary bridge. Similarly, if your banker is helpful, then your mortgage doesn't get foreclosed on and you don't get evicted. Another big source of migration is you lose your home. Mm-hmm. So these are ways finance can help.
Unfortunately, in the social sciences, we don't get to do the experiments that we would like to do. And I think a concern with these kinds of studies is that access to finance can also help in different ways, in more indirect ways, so that in areas where you have lots of access to finance, historically, those parts of the country may have a more diversified economic base. And that's a very different mechanism than the ones you just heard. And that different, more diversified economic base means that farmers, if they get hit with the drought, can go work elsewhere, and so the effects of the drought are less bad. And then on top of that, the access to finance also is not randomly assigned across space. And so the concern with a study like this is you want to distinguish whether the mechanisms are indeed access to finance, or whether it's coming from things like banks are located where people have more incomes. And so it's not necessarily access to finance that's driving these outcomes, but it might be that these individuals are just wealthy and can self-insure against these kinds of shocks. And so we have a lot of plausible mechanisms that say access to finance matters. We then have indirect mechanisms that say it can matter further. And then we have a lot of ancillary pathways through which it can work, correlated with access to finance, but not necessarily access to finance being the causal channel. It matters for policy, right? If you say that something is access to finance, but the mechanisms are fundamentally different, then you get the wrong thing in place. And so that's why, as empiricists, you have to be careful in sort of trying to understand what the mechanisms are.
I emphasize the farmer's ability to build irrigation facilities if they have access to finance. But supposing it was one of the mechanisms that Rodney talked about, that the area itself is well diversified, so that the farmer stops farming but then takes up carpentry or something like that because of the drought. Well, that would have some of the effects that we talk about. Of course, we look directly at whether farmers continue farming, but it would have some of the effects we talk about. But from a policy perspective, the answer is not go out and lend to these farmers. It's, you know, the damage has already been done. There is no diversification. Yeah. And now there's no point lending because you don't have all these other industries in the area. And so there is no policy, you know, need to increase access to finance at that point. So you see that it matters what the mechanism is. And of course, if it's just the fact that people in areas where there are banks are wealthier, again, improving access to finance will have no effect in that area because you can't change wealth.
Seemed like when I was a kid, we'd always get 1-2 inches of rain. About 54 on it, you started shutting down the rain. In this part of the country and from here on west, if we didn't get rain, we were going to not have much of a crop the next year. The driest year I can ever remember was 1956.
I have to admit, I was ignorant of the details of this 1950s drought. I knew about the Dust Bowl from the 1930s. It was a very serious drought. Where did it happen? Who did it affect?
So to contrast it with the Dust Bowl occurred in the mid-1920s, extended out through the 1930s. The Dust Bowl is primarily in the upper Midwest and across the Plain States. Mm-hmm. The 1950s drought comes in a fundamentally different geographic space.
Well, we had a pretty good sized herd of production cows, and we had them on pasture. Since it quit raining, the grass just shriveled up and died and turned brown. So that meant we had to sell all of the cattle.
It hits the southwest of the United States. So states like Texas, the lower parts of California, that's where it's centered. Mm-hmm. And of course, it extends all the way east as well, but it's in the lower latitudes of the United States. All the wells are dry, there's no rain, and the land is a hard scrabble land. So it plays a famous role across the United States, especially in the Southwest, but it doesn't get the billing of the 1930s.
Do you have sufficient data to be able to track the extent of this drought and the granularity to show which communities are hardest hit by it?
No data set is perfect, but no. One of the attractive things of the U.S. is the government has funded a lot of the data collection. And so you have data going back from 1895 at the county level and even at finer grids, spatial grids that can document rainfall patterns for the last maybe 120 years. So it's not perfect, but in terms of being able to measure these things, the government funding has been a great boon.
And it's sort of fascinating, the array of data there are, right? Including, for example, underground water, where it's located, what depth it's at, et cetera, et cetera. It's a researcher's delight.
It is an extraordinary effort reading through your paper to see how much detail you need about credit availability and bank activity. Did you have enough data on that as well?
Well, that was the hard part, the last part, which was banks, because we actually had to collect it by hand. We had a bunch of very eager, willing, and unfortunate research assistants who went through pages and pages of old bank books collecting data on which banks were in which town, etc. So that was hard, but the other data more easily available from census data and so on, the demographics. Yeah.
They were probably more eager at the beginning of the project than they were at the end of it, I guess.
We could sense a drop off in enthusiasm.
I should add that the iPhone helped a great deal when we began. So we had begun this maybe back in 2010 with a different paper, and back then it was pre-iPhone, and so these guys had to like hand enter the data. Now with the iPhone, they could take shots of the pages and send it to India to have people put stuff in. So the technology did evolve as well.
So tell me about some of the results from this. First of all, the impact of low credit on population growth in these areas that were affected by drought, because you've already explained to me this is one mechanism that we see the drought working on communities. What was that effect?
We do see, obviously, droughts tend to lead to population declines in areas, But what you also see is that in the areas with greater credit availability, the extent of decline is much more attenuated. So that's one example of the effect of credit. Another is that it depends a lot on your credit availability versus the credit availability of nearby towns.
Mm-hmm.
Supposing your area is particularly hamstrung in terms of credit, you tend to see a lot of out-migration, but especially if neighboring areas are much more plentifully supplied. And vice versa, if you're plentifully supplied, you may not see much out-migration.
What shook me, what I did not expect, was the persistence. So I thought in the United States, you have a drought, 1950, 1960, it would go away. Once the rains come again, it's fine. And when we looked at the data and began to see the effects in 1970, 1980, 1990, I did not expect to see that. Because my priors were, well, the manufacturing sector would step in, the other sectors would develop, and people wouldn't necessarily leave. And if they did leave, they'd come back. And the fact that the migration was a persistent and permanent feature of the landscape shocked me.
And you have enough data and enough detail in the data to be able to say this is caused by the drought. It's not just a feature of the area that we see in the long run.
So, I mean, the word cause, you always have to be careful in the social sciences. Mm-hmm. But I think a fair interpretation of the evidence is that the migration patterns we're seeing are not an artifact of some kind of a trend.
Mm-hmm.
Droughts are pretty random events. You know, it's not predictable. And in the years before the drought, there's no such pattern. And then after the drought takes place, you do see the migration starting. I'm choosing my words carefully. I'm inclined to say it's causal.
One argument could be there are time effects, but that's where we also have cross-sectional differences. Some areas are drought-prone, others are not. And the difference between them exists, and that's what we exploit also. And you have a third difference, which is access to credit. Mm. You put all three together, and we get the results that we're talking about.
What's behind these migration patterns? Is it people moving out? Is it people not moving in? Is it people that are already there, not having kids? What's going on?
It's actually all of the above, right? One of the things we see is relatively fewer, and let me be careful, this is a weak result, but relatively fewer people of working age in those areas,
mm-hmm.
relatively more older people. So the people who are sort of stuck and who are not looking for a job, they stay, but the younger people move. We see birth rates come down. We see death rates go up. That seems natural if you have relatively older people staying in the area. We can't distinguish that carefully in migration from out migration. What we see more is net migration out of these areas is significant.
Where there is credit, the areas that are lucky enough to have credit, what is it being used for to help these communities cope and adapt?
What we seem to find is that access to credit does seem to finance a shift to different kinds of crops that are able to withstand the drought better. We see that access to credit does allow certain kinds of farmers to dig deeper wells.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, there's an interesting picture in the paper where the depth of wells begin to widen in drought-affected parts of the country in places that have access to credit versus places that don't. And that seems to suggest that farmers, again, have access to capital to dig these wells, to get the water to continue farming. We see also some differences in the capital intensity of farming. So the drought, it coincides with the post-war time period.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a time period where you have rapid changes in technology and the size of engines that come from the war and now get built into trucks and tractors. In places that were exposed to the drought and had access to credit, you see a leapfrogging. Those places now invest in mechanized forms of farming that even make them more productive than the places that never had the drought in the first place. And that's a finding I didn't expect to see. I don't think we expected that. And I want to be careful again. I don't want to push it too far. I think it's hard to say that it's causal, but I think it's plausible that the leapfrogging did take place.
One reason for that could be, look, you were a little more uncertain about crops even without the drought when you didn't have irrigation facilities. Mm-hmm. Once you have irrigation facilities, you are more sure you will get a reasonable and bountiful crop. So then you start having bigger storage facilities. You also think that now you can afford, but also use bigger tractors, bigger combines, and so on. So there's sort of a virtuous circle once you've eliminated the initial hesitancy. Arguably, what's the best time to build irrigation facilities if it's going to take up some of your time and take up some of your land? Well, when you're not really doing anything productive at that point because you're in the middle of a drought. So you might as well prepare for the post-drought years or even for alleviating the drought. And that's why you make these investments, even if you didn't make them in normal times. It could be that everything comes together at this time for those who have the capacity to actually allow them to leapfrog. And again, want to be careful about that result, but it's an interesting possibility.
So I would hesitate to call this a good news story because the people affected by this drought faced up to enormous difficulties, but there are some positive aspects to this, as you say, the potential to leapfrog and to adapt to new technologies. But this is a story of adaptation to one type of shock in one region with a particular set of financial institutions, well-developed financial institutions. How much of it can we say is relevant to the sort of challenges of climate adaptation that we are going to be facing up to in low middle income countries in the next decade, two decades?
I think the channels are reasonable and should exist there also. I think the idea that you want to offset climate volatility with better water management, whether it's a downpour that you shape the land to be able to store it for the bad times, or whether it is your ability to dig deeper into those reservoirs for the times that the water doesn't actually show up. We need much better water management, and that requires resources. And so what we're saying is that even in primarily agricultural societies, let's not minimize the role of investment. I mean, we can all think of ways that you can build barriers in the sea to prevent low-lying areas from being flooded, etc. Those are massive investments. There may be very, very important investments to preserve livelihoods, which are not so much about thwarting the sea or things like that, but really about managing water, managing crops. How do you move people to hardier crops and away from things like rice that require enormous quantities of water? That's a big issue in India, where we have excessive rice farming and too little crop diversification, including crops that can be more nutritious. So what we're saying is that the West, because a lot of the burden is on the West right now, to think about financing poorer countries in the quote-unquote global South, that financing can come with many benefits. One, it can put the global South on a more even keel and essentially allow them to fend for themselves once that financing is in place, and certainly over time repay that financing. But equally important, it prevents the migration that could otherwise overwhelm industrial countries. For example, the floods in Pakistan certainly has created dramatic problems for farmers there. And I have no doubt that over time that will translate into migration through the normal routes of Iran, the Middle East, and then up into Europe. So historically, migration has always been the answer. We see it within a country as the answer to climate volatility. The problem, however, is when it is between countries, which seems the natural way that we will see migration in the coming decades, it creates a lot of frictions. So we're saying that one way to reduce that is to try and make livelihoods more secure in the countries that are subject to volatility.
Even in the United States, in the Depression and the Dust Bowl, the migration out of the Dust Bowl into California caused a lot of problems. So you had the Okies, people coming from the upper Midwest and moved to California, and you had the settlement camps here, and that led to a great deal of tension between the native people in California, the native as in the white population in California, reacting with resentment to the people coming from Oklahoma to settle here. And these are people in the same country. So trying to make access to finance more plentiful and more sensible, I think, is helpful to prevent the inter-country movement of people, which I don't think works as well as we would like.
Yeah. Does this mean it's good policy in the near future to compel more lending, even when it is not perhaps commercially viable, just because it has so many possible external benefits?
A clever transfer of finance would be a good thing. Sometimes when we say forced, it seems almost like we're just going to force feed a bunch of poor countries with a lot of money and they will figure it out. No, I mean, it matters how it's used also, which means that it has to get to the farmer, not be siphoned off along the way. I don't want to overemphasize corruption and leakage, but I think it's important that even in the lending, it be done with care so that what you're doing is financing adaptation in a careful and clever way. What we're saying is that, yes, more financing would be a good thing, subsidized if possible for the really poor countries, grants for the real, real problematic areas. But even then, it has to go from there to the people in a judicious way so that they make best use of it. There's no point pouring it down a black hole. And that's really what we need to think about when we think about these transfers.
Keep in mind that the banks in our sample were embedded in the community for like 20 to 30 years prior, if not longer. And so they had the knowledge and the institutional capacity to make these loans well. If you try to then translate or scale that up to lending across borders where the banks or the bankers may not have a vested interest serving the community nor understand whom should be getting these loans, I think the outcomes could be quite different.
It's a fascinating piece of work. Thank you both for talking about it today. Thank you, Raghuram.
Thank you, Tim.
Rodney, thank you as well.
Thank you, of course, Tim.
The paper is called Finance and Climate Resilience, Evidence from the Long 1950s Drought. You have been hearing from both of the authors. This has been a Vox Dev Talk. The best way to make sure you don't miss an episode is to subscribe. You'll find us wherever you get your podcasts. And our past episodes, as always, are at voxdev.org, where we also have articles about the papers we feature.